Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. In light of rising insecurity in Sudan, the UN announced on Monday that it is evacuating international staff from the country amid a second week of fighting between rival military forces. The measure aims to reduce risk to personnel while continuing to deliver assistance to the population. Hundreds of staff have been temporarily relocated from the capital, Khartoum, to the eastern city of Port Sudan for onward evacuation to neighboring countries where they will work remotely. The UN is also taking necessary measures to protect Sudanese staff members and their families and is exploring every possible avenue to support them. UN Special Representative in Sudan, Volker Perthes, will remain in the country together with a small number of internationally recruited personnel and will continue to work towards a resolution to the current crisis and returning to UN-mandated tasks. In New York, Secretary General Antonio Guterres welcomed the safe temporary relocation of UN staff members and dependents from Khartoum and other locations. The Secretary General reiterated his call on the parties to immediately stop the fighting, spelling out to the Security Council that the UN is not leaving Sudan. The COVID-19 pandemic caused millions of children to miss out on routine vaccines, and countries must act now to restore essential immunization coverage to at least 2019 levels, UN Health Agency WHO said on Monday, marking the start of World Immunization Week. Under the banner of the Big Catch-Up, WHO, that's the World Health Organization, is working with partners to support countries to get back on track so that more people are protected from preventable diseases. An estimated 25 million children missed out on vaccination in 2021 alone, and WHO is highlighting successful campaigns underway in different countries, including Ghana, where the new malaria vaccine has been added to routine immunization schedules in several health facilities. World Immunization Week runs from the 24th to the 30th of April. WHO said the ultimate goal is to ensure more children, adults, and their communities are protected from vaccine-preventable diseases, allowing them to live happier, healthier lives. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for finding new ways to harness data today to shape a peaceful and prosperous tomorrow for all people and the planet. In a video message to the opening of the UN World Data Forum in Hangzhou, China on Monday, he warned that progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, has stalled or even reversed halfway to the 2030 deadline. He said the forum is a key opportunity to turbocharge the transformative power of data and accelerate progress at this critical moment. Deanne Penn, UN News.
That's right. We're live today. We'll have the second hour, John Grant Live. This can't be happening Tuesday. And you're more than welcome to call in, even in the first hour. However, you'll probably end up in the green room visiting with me off and on between clips. We are fortunate today. We have the latest this morning, the Democracy Now! Available. And here we go.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, a 72-hour ceasefire appears to be largely holding, though there are reports of scattered gunfire and shelling in the capital, Khartoum. Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces agreed to begin the three-day truce at midnight following 2 days of negotiations brokered by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. At least 459 civilians have died since fighting between the rival factions of Sudan's military junta broke out on April 15th, though the true toll is certain to be far higher. Water, food, medicine, electricity, and communications remain in short supply. Damage to sanitation systems have spawned fears of waterborne diseases like cholera, as some residents have been forced to drink water directly from the Nile River. This is Rawan Awalid, who left her family behind in Khartoum as she fled to Egypt.
أخوي وأهلي بابي خالاتي صحباتي أصحابي.
I left behind my brother, my family, the rest of my aunts and my friends. Yes, I survived, but I'm still worried about those I left behind. The situation is extremely catastrophic. There are no hospitals. 55 hospitals are out of service. This is very bad. I don't know how they are living.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning of a high risk of biological hazards in Khartoum after fighters seized control of a national laboratory holding pathogens, including measles and poliovirus. Ukraine's military has advanced onto the eastern bank of the Dnieper River in the Kherson region as part of a long-anticipated spring counteroffensive against Russian forces. A spokesperson for Ukraine's military refused to confirm the reports, but said heavy Russian shelling in the region had injured civilians and destroyed dozens of buildings, including a school. China's foreign ministry has walked back comments by a senior Chinese diplomat questioning the sovereignty of Ukraine and other former Soviet states. Liu Shai, China's ambassador to France, said on Friday the nations, quote, do not have an effective status in international law, unquote. That prompted several nations, including Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, to summon Chinese envoys to explain Beijing's official position. In a statement, China's foreign ministry said Liu's comments were not a political declaration but an expression of personal points of view during a televised debate, unquote. We'll have more on this story after headlines. A new report finds worldwide military spending rose to an all-time high of over $2.2 trillion last year, largely driven by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The United States accounted for nearly 40% of total military spending, even though it's just over 4% of the world's population. The U.S. also remained the world's largest arms exporter by far. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will run for re-election in 2024. Biden made the official announcement this morning with a three-minute campaign video posted on social media.
Freedom, personal freedom, is fundamental to who we are as Americans.
There's nothing more important, nothing more sacred.
That's been the work of my first term, to fight for our democracy.
This shouldn't be a red or blue issue.
Protect our rights, to make sure that everyone in this country is treated equally.
So far, Biden and Harris face two Democratic primary challengers, self-help author Marianne Williamson, who also ran in 2020, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., an environmental lawyer, anti-vaccine activist, and son of the former U.S. Attorney General and assassinated 1968 presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy. CBS News reports RFK Jr. was convinced to run by Trump's former campaign manager, Steve Bannon, who believes he will be a useful chaos agent in the 2024 race. Fox News announced Monday the cable network and its far-right primetime host, Tucker Carlson, quote, agreed to part ways, unquote. His departure was effective immediately. Interim presenters are replacing Carlson, who has not commented about the reason for his firing. The surprise departure of the top-rated host comes after text messages from Carlson were revealed in the Dominion Voting Systems lawsuit against Fox News for airing false claims of a stolen election that was just settled last week for over $750 million. Later in the broadcast, we'll look at how Tucker Carlson has been a singular force driving Fox News's extremism. Meanwhile, CNN's fired news anchor Don Lemon, ending his 17-year tenure at the network. Lemon was accused of sexism after he recently said 51-year-old Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley was past her prime. And Variety reported earlier this month Lemon had a history of threatening and mocking female staffers at CNN. In Atlanta, Georgia, Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis has revealed she'll announce this summer whether she's filing criminal charges against Donald Trump and others over Trump's effort to overturn Joe Biden's victory in Georgia in 2020. Willis wrote in a letter to law enforcement she expects to announce possible criminal indictments between July 11th and September 1st and is asking for heightened security and preparedness. Here in New York, jury selection has begun in a civil trial against Donald Trump brought by author E. Jean Carroll. The former magazine columnist alleges Trump raped her in a dressing room at a department store in the mid-90s. Carroll can bring the case decades later because New York opened a one-year window on statute of limitations for adult survivors of sexual assault. The judge in the civil case has ruled two other women who say they were sexually assaulted by Trump can take the stand as well. The chair of the Senate Finance Committee has asked Texas billionaire and conservative activist Harlan Crow to provide Congress with a detailed list of undisclosed gifts and payments benefiting Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, including private real estate transactions and the use of Crow's private jet and superyacht. In a letter sent to Crow Monday, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden wrote, quote, "The secrecy surrounding your dealings with Justice Thomas is simply unacceptable. The American public deserves a full accounting of the full extent of your largesse towards Justice Thomas, including whether these gifts complied with all relevant federal tax and ethic laws," unquote. Meanwhile, Bloomberg News is reporting Justice Thomas failed to recuse himself from a 2005 Supreme Court decision to reject a case that benefited the Trammell Crow Residential Company, a real estate firm named after Harlan Crow's father that was partly owned by the Crow family. Harlan Crow was CEO and chair of the board at the time. In North Dakota, Republican Governor Doug Burgum has signed into law a near-total ban on abortion that would only allow people to get the procedure in cases of rape or incest during the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. The legislation is one of the most severe anti-abortion measures in the country. Reproductive rights advocates say most people don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. In Montana, protesters rallied inside the state capitol Monday and supported Democratic transgender state representative Zoe Zephyr after Republican lawmakers blocked her from speaking on the House floor for a third day. Zephyr raised her microphone into the air as her supporters interrupted proceedings for nearly half an hour, leading to the arrest of at least seven people.
Our guests will come to order. Sergeant of Arms, will you please clear the gallery?
Republicans have denied Zephyr's repeated request to debate on proposed anti-trans legislation after last week she told them they would have blood on their hands if they banned gender-affirming health care for trans children and youth. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, Grammy-winning rapper and singer Lizzo invited dozens of drag performers on stage during a concert in Knoxville Friday night, protesting Republicans' efforts to ban public drag performances in the state. Tennessee Republican Governor Bill Lee signed the measure into law last February, but it was blocked by a federal judge the following month, arguing it was too vaguely written. President Biden Monday welcomed Tennessee Democratic Representatives Justin Pearson, Justin Jones, and Gloria Johnson to the White House for a discussion on gun reform. The lawmakers became known as the Tennessee Three after facing Republican-led expulsion votes from the state legislature for supporting recent student protests calling for gun control after six people, including 3 9-year-old students, were killed in a mass shooting at a Nashville elementary school in March. Pearson and Jones, who were the only two formerly expelled, were unanimously reappointed to the Tennessee House of Representatives by local officials in Memphis and Nashville earlier this month. This is Justin Jones speaking Monday from the Rose Garden.
We lifted this issue above the partisan divide that this is not left or right, but we talked to the president about how this is a moral issue, an issue of conscience, an issue in the South where we are trying to build multiracial democracy and challenge these extreme forces that, rather than passing an assault weapons ban, they assaulted our democracy, as we saw when we were expelled from the state legislature.
In Pennsylvania, the trial for the man accused of killing 11 worshipers at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018 began Monday. The mass shooting was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. In Kentucky, the Carroll County Sheriff's Office has hired the former Louisville police detective who fired the shot that killed 26-year-old black emergency room technician Breonna Taylor in her own home during a no-knock raid in March 2020. Miles Cosgrove was fired from the Louisville Metro Police Department in January 2021 for violating use of force procedures and failing to use a body camera. In northwestern Pakistan, at least 17 people were killed, more than 50 others wounded Monday as a pair of explosions tore through an ammunition depot run by Pakistan's counterterrorism office in the Swat Valley. Most of the dead were police officers, though at least four were civilians. A police spokesperson said the blast was triggered when ammunition caught fire, likely due to an electrical short circuit. And the 2022 Goldman Environmental Prize recipients have been announced. In Brazil, the indigenous leader Alessandra Korup won for leading a campaign against the mining giant Anglo American, safeguarding 400,000 acres of Amazon rainforest.
It was a huge victory. We realized that we are like little ants. When the little ants join forces, we get stronger. And we got stronger until we won the battle against Anglo American.
Here in the United States, environmental activist and fourth-generation shrimper Diane Wilson also received a Goldman Prize for winning a historic $50 million settlement in a case against Formosa Plastics for dumping toxic waste on Texas's Gulf Coast. The 2019 civil settlement was the largest in the history of the Clean Water Act. This is Diane Wilson.
Formosa makes a trillion pellets or nurdles a day. And they lose a lot of the powder and the pellets through 10 stormwater outfalls. And so Formosa was discharging this plastic everywhere. And they have been doing this for 27 years.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in flux as we record on April 20th, the Supreme Court has briefly punted their decision on restricting access to medication abortion drug mifepristone. The American Medical Association said that the recent ruling by a Texas federal judge revoking the FDA's approval of mifepristone, which has been in widespread use for more than two decades now, quote, flies in the face of science and evidence and threatens to upend access to a safe and effective drug, close quote. For the Washington Post, that's part of a confusing legal battle. But for the majority of people, including doctors, it's not confusing, just frightening. We'll hear from Rachel K. Jones, research scientist at Guttmacher Institute. Also on the show, Rutgers University faculty members strike, halting classes and research. That April 10th New York Times headline reflects standard operating procedure for corporate news media, reporting labor actions in terms of their ostensible harms rather than the harms that led to them. The strike by a range of differently situated Rutgers faculty, the Times said, will affect roughly 67,000 students across the state. Well, presumably those are the same students affected by teachers, researchers, and counselors working in circumstances so precarious and so untenable that they took the difficult and potentially life-altering step of withholding their labor. That go-to elite media framework, those pesky workers, what are they up to this time, is just one more element making efforts to increase workers' power in the workplace that much harder. The thing is, it doesn't always work. Lots of people see through and around it, and the gains made by Rutgers faculty and the example that that sets is evidence. We'll get an update from Donna Murch, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers and New Brunswick Chapter President of AAUPAFT. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. As we record on Thursday, April 20th, the U.S. Supreme Court has extended until tomorrow its decision on whether reproductive rights will be severely curtailed, including in so-called blue states, by restricting access to mifepristone, approved for more than 20 years as part of a medical method of terminating pregnancies. The Washington Post tells readers, quote, "The Biden administration, abortion providers and anti-abortion activists, drug makers and the Food and Drug Administration have engaged in a rapid and at times confusing legal battle over mifepristone," close quote. Well, that suggests a sort of informational free-for-all in the face of an actual disinformation campaign on the part of a minority of Americans opposed to the right to choose when and whether to have a child. To the extent that there is any cloudiness around the science or the human rights involved here, one would hope that journalists would sort it and not throw up their hands. Rachel K. Jones is principal research scientist at Guttmacher Institute, the research and policy group focused on sexual and reproductive health and rights. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Rachel Jones.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Well, very narrowly, this Supreme Court case is about the authority of the FDA to approve drugs. But anybody paying attention can see that it's actually about much more. I wonder if you could just tell us a bit first about the impact of the introduction of medication abortion. It's been 20 years now. What has that meant in terms of the ability of people to access abortion, and how widely is it used?
Right. So we know from decades of medical research that mifepristone is safe, effective, and widely accepted by both patients and providers. And Guttmacher's own research has established that the majority of abortions are done with medication abortions, 53% in 2020.
So what would we expect, I mean, immediately and then maybe longer term, if this effort to make mifepristone unavailable, if that were to actually go through, what sort of impacts would you be expecting?
Okay, so there's actually a lot that we don't know about what's going to happen or what would happen if the Supreme Court were to impose restrictions on mifepristone. But again, it's important to recognize that any restrictions that are put in place are not based on medical science. We do know that it would have a devastating, any restrictions that were put in place would have a devastating impact on abortion access. Again, 53% of abortions are medication abortions. Currently, 55% of women in the U.S., only 55% of women in the U.S. live in a county that has an abortion provider. And if mifepristone were taken away, that number would drop to 51%. But it would have a big impact. There are 10 states that would have a substantially larger, notable impact. So about 40% of clinics in the U.S. only offer medication abortion. And so again, there's 10 states where if this was taken, if these clinics were taken away, if these providers were taken away, that substantially large proportions of people would no longer have access to abortion. And some of these are states that are actually supportive of abortion rights, states like Colorado, Washington, New Mexico. And again, just one example, in Colorado, it's currently the case that 82% of women living in Colorado live in a county that has an abortion provider. If mifepristone were no longer available, this number would drop to 56%.
I think it's important the way that Guttmacher links health and rights, you know, and the way that your work shows that access, sometimes media presented as though we're talking about the United States and rights to access to abortion in the United States, but it varies very much, as you're just indicating, by region, by state, and then also by socioeconomic status. So there are a number of things to consider here in terms of this potential impact, yeah?
Definitely. Again, we know from decades of Guttmacher research on people who have abortions that it's people in disadvantaged populations, low-income populations, people of color who access abortion at higher rates than other groups. And so by default, any restriction on abortion, whether it's a complete ban, a gestational ban, a ban on a certain type of method, on a medication abortion, it's going to disproportionately impact these groups that are already, again, at a disadvantage.
Well, and I think particularly when we're talking about medication abortion, you know, if you know, you know. If you never thought about it, then maybe you never thought about it. But there's a difference between having to go to a clinic where maybe you're going to go through a phalanx of, you know, red-faced people screaming at you, and
right.
the ability to access that care in other ways. It's an important distinction, yeah?
Definitely. You know, one of the benefits of medication abortion of mifepristone is that it can be offered via telemedicine. You know, if there's a consultation, it can be done online or over the phone, and then the drugs can be mailed to somebody. There are online pharmacies that can provide medication abortion. This means that people, right, don't have to travel to a clinic, that they don't have to, in some cases, travel hundreds of miles to get to a clinic, that they don't have to worry about childcare and taking off time from work. So, again, medication abortion has the ability to, and has for a number of people, made abortion more accessible.
Well, if you talk to staunch anti-abortion people, the conversation is very rarely about science or about medicine, you know. But then some of them and their media folks will throw around terms that sort of suggest that they're being science-y. You know, they'll talk about viability or heartbeat, or they'll say it's about concern about the safety of drugs. And I just wonder, as a scientist who actually is immersed in this stuff, what do you make of the reporting on the medical reality of abortion? And would more knowledge help inform the broader conversation, or is it just two kind of different conversations? What do you think?
Right. I definitely think it's two different conversations. Like I said, we have decades of scientific medical research establishing that medication abortion is safe, effective, and widely accepted. People who don't support abortion choose to ignore the science and the safety and dig for their own factoids and supposed scientific facts to support their arguments.
It's so strange how the media debate always seems to start again and again at point zero, you know, as though there were no facts in the matter or
right.
no experience, and as though women aren't experts on their own experience, you know.
Right.
Well, finally, we see things like the Women's Health Protection Act, you
mm-hmm.
know, federalizing the right to abortion. I know the law is not necessarily your purview, but in terms of responding to these court moves and these state-level moves, do you think that federal action is the way to go?
Certainly, that is one solution, right? The Women's Health Protection Act would enshrine the right to abortion federally. But we also need, and especially in the current environment, I don't want to say Women's Health Protection Act is pie in the sky, but given everything that's going on right now, we also need federal and state policymakers to step up to restore, protect, and expand access to abortion. A lot of these restrictions are imposed. I mean, quite frankly, you know, the right to abortion was removed because of Roe, and that allows states to impose pretty much any restriction that they want to. We're seeing from all these different laws that are being implemented. And so it really is a lot of times at the state level, and certainly in the current environment, the state level is what we might need to focus on.
And then anything you would like to see more of or less of from journalism in this regard?
You know, on medication abortion, it seems like the media is actually doing a decent job of covering the issue, of acknowledging, again, the decades of research showing that medication abortion is safe, effective, and commonly used. I guess the only issue we might have is one that you see anytime that abortion is the subject of media stories, and that is a lot of times reporters think, well, if they have to take a fair and balanced approach, that means that they have to talk to the people who oppose abortion. And again, when this is about science and facts and research, then you don't need to talk to people who don't believe in it, don't believe in sound science, or who are going to ignore, again, decades of solid medical research.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Rachel K. Jones, Principal Research Scientist at Guttmacher Institute. You can find their myriad resources online at guttmacher.org. Thank you so much, Rachel Jones, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me.
Thousands of teachers, full-time, tenured, part-time, part-time, adjunct, grad students, counselors, and others at New Jersey's Rutgers University went on strike this month in unprecedented labor action at the 257-year-old institution. Workers standing up anywhere can have rippling effects, but somehow when it is educators at a public university, there seems to be an added opportunity to find some lessons in the fight. The story at Rutgers is still unfolding. We're joined now for an update by Donna Murch, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers and New Brunswick Chapter President of Rutgers AAUP-AFT. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Donna Murch.
Hi, Janine. It's a pleasure to be here. You know I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, thank you very much. Listeners should know we're recording on Thursday, April 20th, and I'm reading that the strike is over and also that it's not over. And I also hear that some real concrete gains that workers were calling for have been secured. So maybe fill us in on the current state of affairs.
So we went on strike last Monday, not this past Monday, but roughly 10 days ago, and it was the first strike in Rutgers' 257-year history of its academic workers. There was a strike, I think, in 1987 of AFSCME workers. An injunction was used against them, but there's never been a strike of academic workers, and this is a big deal because it is a multi-union strike, and it is cross-job category. So it includes three unions: the Rutgers AAUP-AFT, which covers grad workers, postdocs, EOS counselors, non-tenure track lecturers, full-time faculty, and tenure stream faculty. And the university is a very hierarchical place, and so our union includes these many different categories, which is quite rare. It goes back to 1970, but we've managed to build a powerful campaign that has brought all these different groups together, as well as forming a direct alliance with the PTLSC, which is the Part-Time Lecturers for Faculty, and the BHSNJ, which is the Union for Medical Workers. So this is really quite remarkable. There are 9,000 people. There were 9,000 people on strike from last Monday to Friday. And then after a marathon bargaining session at the governor's mansion, and I can talk about what's happening with that because it's quite important to understanding the dynamic, they came to an agreement that's called a legal framework. It's not yet a tentative agreement, which is a legal category. So first you start with a framework, then the tentative agreement, and then the signed contract. So we're still in that process of bargaining both economic and non-economic demands. We agreed as an executive council to suspend the strike to continue negotiations. And there were several reasons this happened. The first is that we have been under a lot of pressure. Sadly, our president, Jonathan Holloway, who came to Rutgers in July 2020, he has proved very, very anti-union. I think there are ways that you could argue that he's the most anti-union president that we've had. So when it became clear that negotiations were breaking down, we have not had a contract now for almost 290 days. Our contracts of all the unions at Rutgers, with the exception of AFSCME, were up in June. And the administration has just been terrible. They often wouldn't come to the bargaining table. When they did, they would repeat the same things over and over. They refused to address specific proposals by all the different job categories, including the graduate students who submitted their proposals in May. And we've only begun bargaining them over the last month, as true of many other categories of workers as well as proposals. So when the negotiations began to break down about a month ago, Jonathan Holloway sent a letter directly from the president to all of the different faculty, grad workers, all the different categories within our bargaining unit. And he also sent it to all of the undergraduates. And it was a very threatening letter. He said that public sector strikes in New Jersey are illegal
And those that participate in them can be, the individuals can be fined, the unions can be fined, and there's threat of arrest. And to engage in this kind of job action would be met with essentially the penalty. Now, what was striking about this is that it is not true. Public sector strikes in New Jersey are not illegal. There is no statute covering them. In order to make a strike illegal, the employer, in this case Jonathan Holloway, if there's a strike, he goes to a court and seeks an injunction. And then once he gets it, sometimes they're granted, sometimes they're not. Most of the injunctions against public sector workers, sadly, have been used by against grade school teachers and K through 12 teachers in school districts. So once you get the injunction, you go back to the striking workers, usually with a cease and desist order to tell them to stop. And then if they don't stop, then you have to go to a second hearing and seek penalties. And those penalties can include what I said. The one that I left out is that the kind of complet that's available is a penalties for the whole union, penalties for individuals that cannot be paid by the union, arrest or firing. So, you know, this was a shot across the bow in a working class state like New Jersey that has really tough, gritty class politics, and he miscalculated. So I think that both his strong anti-union stance and he chose a representative, Chris Christie's head of labor relations, who worked for the Christie administration from 2010 to 2014. This is the chief bargainer that our president chose. So I think he really miscalculated what it's like to be at a public university like Rutgers, and that the students, the workers of all kinds are infuriated by this. And it's been met with a real vibrant forms of industrial organizing. You know, we talk about it as intersectional organizing and 21st century industrial unionism in the public sector, which has really, I think, become really the vanguard in one of the most radical wings, partially because people are fighting for public infrastructure, making demands not just about wages, but also bargaining for the common good.
You know, news media seem to virtually always reduce any striking workers' demands to more money, you know, but
exactly.
You're articulating it in a much more complicated and interesting, frankly, context. You know, workers' compensation isn't something that happens in a vacuum. And here at Rutgers, you know, never mind wider society, but here at Rutgers, it's priorities in terms of the use of resources that are at issue, right?
Absolutely. I think this point about wages is incredibly important because first, it, you know, I've been thinking a lot about why this movement is emerging now and what its relationship was even to the world that I grew up in, which was, you know, I was still coming of age under the Cold War, you know, in the 70s and 80s.
Right.
And the attack on the labor movement was so profound, and it happens at a time when also the composition of labor unions is changing, of organized labor itself, and becoming more female, blacker, and browner. And it's in this period that we actually begin to see the real strikes at the public sector. And those two things are happening simultaneously for multiple reasons. But, you know, I always think of George Meany, you know, the first head of the AFL-CIO, who said, the organized fellow is the fellow that counts.
Hmm.
And that was the kind of unionism that, first of all, sacrificed all questions of labor and supported, you know, anti-communist Cold War violence all over the country, including Vietnam. But the domestic focus was on a unionism for the most elite workers, white and male and craft. So today, it's interesting because the university itself is also trying to push us towards wage demand. The thing that's made the union strong is trying to speak to each job category and to privilege the lowest paid, and that includes the adjunct workers, the graduate faculty, and the EOF counselors. So you have faculty using, and we're all doing this, using tenure to fight for the contingent categories of labor. So in that sense, it's a really exciting thing. But it's, you know, whenever I talk to reporters, and I've done a lot of media work, I do this work of, you, I, of course, you already knew, but trying to explain to them why we need to focus on other demands. That said, industrial campaigns are really hard. This is the first strike, and I think having all these job categories is great for building power, but when you come to the bargaining table, you confront the long history of really anti-labor union practices. And I think I've learned many things. Of course, we're still in the midst of it. You asked where we are now. This is, what, Thursday? So it is the fourth day of our suspension. You don't include the weekend. So I think there's going to be a discussion tonight where we get updates from the bargaining table and decide if we're going to resume the strike. There are reasons to resume the strike. You know, there are many demands that we would still like to win, including better language and structures for our non-economic proposals, including 5 years of graduate funding that's centrally funded, and our bargaining for the common good demand to serve communities in New Jersey and fight for undergraduate debt relief. So we'll see. You know, it's very important to know that our strike is suspended, not ended, and that we may go back on strike depending on what the union decides. We do not yet have a tentative agreement. But being involved in this process and seeing bargaining, what I always thought with bargaining is that the problem were people that had narrow demands. But seeing people that I know very well and respect a great deal go through bargaining, it just shows me that, you know, we're having a powerful resurgence of labor organizing, but we're still confronting the narrowness of the possibilities, and we're trying to squeeze ourselves through those narrow channels and widen them, hopefully for all workers, just as, you know, the Chicago Teachers Union, the UTLA Teachers Union in Los Angeles, the, you know, Red Tide in Oklahoma and in West Virginia widened the tide for us.
One of the reasons that I know that people are seeing what's happening at Rutgers as super hopeful is, first of all, the win, the concrete win of increased wages for some folks and acknowledgement and visibility. But it's also the coalitional nature of the work. Tenured professors standing in solidarity with grad students, with researchers and teachers, and then also students, you know, who are refusing the frame that some politicians and some media are using that suggests that their interests are pitted against those of faculty. The breadth of this effort has been important, hasn't it?
It has. I think it's been incredibly important. And this is a way to build power. I also think that one thing I find exciting about Rutgers is that we all know about the incredible social inequality in the U.S. and how it's getting worse day by day. And the only solution I see for this is greater labor organizing, period. Now, I've been involved in many different kinds of activism throughout my life, but I decided to really get involved in the union movement around 2015, 2016, because I saw clearly the rise of racial fascism, you know, the election of Trump, and then later I was in Brazil right after Bolsonaro was elected, and it was one of the most frightening experiences that I've had. And it wasn't because I saw things that were frightening. It had to do with the level of fear of the people that I was visiting, some of whom had had family members killed in the military dictatorship. So I think that the labor unions now, you know, real left labor unions, like the kind we had before Taft-Hartley, are really important for economic gains and also as political opposition.
Thank you, Donna Murch, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced each week by FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows or transcripts, you can find all of that at FAIR.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
All right. Now, I've got a little clip here. Everybody's talking about it. And in the green room this morning with John Grant, who will be on the second hour here coming up in about 15, 20 minutes, first thing he wanted to discuss was the issue of Tucker Carlson losing his position by mutual agreement, evidently. It was mutual agreement between Fox News and Tucker Carlson, him leaving. And on the same day, this all occurred, I believe, on Friday, on the same day, Don Lemon of CNN was, actually, he was sort of rudely laid off, but he was laid off nonetheless. So both millionaires, quote-unquote news journalists, opinionators, they both lost their jobs. And I'm going to play this clip. It's about 15, 16 minutes long from the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. He does a pretty good analysis on many things, but this one that came up quickly last Friday, he is a particularly good clip. And I'll play it, and then we'll have John Grant on to talk about it. Here we go.
Shocking news from Fox. Tucker Carlson out at the network. This is the, I guess, the press release they put out.
Yeah.
Fox News Media and Tucker Carlson part ways. Fox News Media and Tucker Carlson have agreed to part ways. We thank him for his service to the network as a host and prior to that as a contributor. Mr. Carlson's last program was Friday, April 21st. Fox News Tonight will air live at 8 p.m. starting this evening as an interim show helmed by rotating Fox News personalities until a new host is named. I guess he was 8 p.m. He was the 8 p.m. Was he the 8 p.m. show? I thought he was the 9 p.m. show.
No, he's 8, then it leads to Hannity, then it leads to Ingram.
I don't think that's the case. Did they switch that? Because he used to go up against Ray Tremato. I don't know what that means. Maybe they pushed Hannity to 9 p.m.
Yeah, it's at Hannity's 9 now.
I don't think that's always been the case.
I think that a few years ago, Tucker got the 8 p.m. slot, and that's why, you know, he was their crown jewel in terms of ratings.
Well, there you go. So Fox News Media, you may be right about that. Fox News Media, blah, blah, blah.
I like how they have to say part ways, like on a journey and they each take different paths.
You know, sometimes you just start growing apart.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that happens just with absolutely zero notice. And that's what seems to have happened in this instance. He was on Friday night. He said, we'll see you on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
They were advertising, I guess, an interview with that...
Vivek Ramaswamy, and they were advertising it as early as this morning.
Man, I hope somebody leaks that. I really want to see it.
There's a lot of speculation what this could be from. We should say this. He may run for president. We don't know. But I can assure you, this is not the way you would do it if you were running for president. This would not have been planned. You leverage that spot for as long as you can, and you have a sign-off. The network, if there was no issue from the network end, they would be more than happy to, you know, say goodbye and then get the news value out of, like, having one of their anchors run for president. That's not it.
And we know he's very greedy from the Dominion leaks, and so running for president would be quite expensive. He cares a lot about making money.
I mean, yeah, it's hard to imagine they would do that, but who knows? It is conceivable that this was part of the Dominion settlement that just they agreed never to talk about. Because, you know, this is not the first person to go. Dan Bongino was let go the other day as well.
Yeah.
Dan Bongino, I don't think he had a show on Fox, but he was a contributor, and he'd been there quite a while. And if they were to let go of him, they would, you know, you wouldn't have imagined that they would be doing a Monday morning promo. It's conceivable that they, you know, the word hadn't gotten down, you know, to promo that in the morning, and their plan was to get rid of him all along. But what's more than likely, it seems to me, is that there is something else. And that something else could be the Grossberg suit
This is one of his former producers who not only was told to lie during discovery, but apparently there's additional lawsuits that had to do with unspecified sort of like a harassment or unpleasant workplace situation. Now, that's not to suggest that Tucker Carlson was sexually harassing anybody, but it is to suggest that it's possible there's something that some information came from her lawsuit that last week that made Fox realize, okay, we've just got too many problems. Plus we've got this other, you know, Smartmatic coming up. And the way you fire somebody in this type of business, having been fired multiple times at Air America at various times, they generally, if they're worried, if it's a firing and it's a little bit ugly, they will not let you have a final show because they're afraid what you're going to do with it.
Well, I mean, I wonder, and I'm also curious where he goes from here. Is he getting some big offer from Peter Thiel's Rumble? I mean, Thiel has the pockets to do it. And who replaces him? Like, they've been auditioning Tulsi Gabbard in that spot. That would be interesting if they move Hannity back to 8. Who is going to be, I mean, they could really just get like a, they could scroll through libs of TikTok and intercut videos of people getting pushed into the subway tracks and they'd get the same effect of the Tucker Carlson program. But I'm just curious who they think is the future there.
Could be Jesse Waters.
That's the pick. You're right, actually. I think if we're doing, if the betting markets are open, he's going to be minus 200 for that slot.
There you go. I don't know what that means, but I'm
sure
that's
the favorite.
Okay,
and then we put Tulsi at like plus 150, I'm going to say.
And so, I mean, we'll find out. But they also didn't seem to have a plan, right? I mean, the idea, like the rotating thing.
I love that.
I've seen that happen when Randy Rhoads was fired by Mark Green at Air America. They didn't know what to do. So they just said, we'll put a rotating crew of morons in there or something. So that's that. It does remain to be seen. Look, Tucker Carlson has been fired by every major network, news network there is. MSNBC, CNN, and now Fox. It's conceivable he would go to O-N-E, but I can't imagine a network like that is going to pay him the same amount of money. I don't know if Peter Thiel would hire him to be on YouTube, but my sense is going from the highest rated cable television host to Rumble, even if you're getting a big chunk of money, it may take a while for him to make that transition. Because happening too quickly is a little bit embarrassing.
My guess is that he wants to be able to say, do white supremacist news hour, but more unfiltered. Like, you know, he doesn't just have to speak in code to the white supremacists who watch a show once and then twice, so that they can get messages from it. He can be a little bit more explicit if he goes online.
He can still do, like, you know, his whatever he was doing, his online show or whatever. But in many respects, more importantly, he'll continue to do that show. But it doesn't have the same gravitas. And, of course, the other thing is that it's unclear who would follow him to online. He has more than other cable television shows. He has a younger demo than most because he's appealing, you know, to a psychographic as opposed to a demographic. That psychographic obviously being, white nationalism. And they may follow him to Rumble or wherever he might go. Or he just might, he doesn't strike me as the type of guy who's going to not try and get back into this because he is driven by such a desperate compulsion for fame and money that it would be hard to imagine that he's not going to. But if I was him, retirement, that's what I would do.
Yeah, but
I'd be planting some shrubberies. What are the odds that Tucker Carlson now runs for president? I don't know. He's lazy.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think he wants that kind of, I've been wrong about this. This is exactly what I said about Trump. Like, he just wants, like he doesn't actually want to run because it's a big headache. But I seen, like, Tucker talk about Trump, saying, like, he's a destroyer. We need to, like, basically get the ships in formation. And, you know, that doesn't seem like a guy who wants that attention. Mm.
I don't know who Tucker would bring value to that would be willing to sort of, like, bankroll his campaign, but who knows? Tucker not even giving a statement in that press release is wild. Just sad how no one wants to work these days. Barbara.
I know. Don Lemon at least put out some weird statement with blue font. You see that?
What's that?
Don Lemon tweeted out that he was unceremoniously fired, and he's very upset.
I haven't followed.
Do you really want a ceremony when that happens, though?
Yes. What's a firing ceremony?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Like some British parliamentary
exactly.
thing?
Exactly. Barbic, great news about Tucker. Made my day. Hope he doesn't run for office. Here is Don Lemon tweeting out. I was
very hurt.
I was informed this morning by my agent that I have been terminated by CNN. I am stunned. After 17 years at CNN, I would have thought someone in management would have the decency to tell me directly. At no time was I ever given any indication that I would not be able to continue to do the work I have loved at the network.
I mean, okay, from the outside, it seemed clear he was on the hot seat. We all know that he was suspended for his comments about women being past their prime after 35.
Like multiple times he's been suspended for that, too.
Yeah, and it's not, and by the way, it wasn't like prime in terms of childbirth. It would be a weird thing to bring that up. He said it, he conflated it with people's careers.
Yeah, it was pretty.
That's like not cool.
No, it was creepy.
Was that a thing where, like, Greenwald was like, wow, look at what Don Lemon gets away with?
And yeah, so, right. Well,
not really.
Yeah, he didn't.
Not so much.
Exactly.
I wonder if they did this, if they timed it, if they heard that, like, that Tucker was going to get fired, hey. And they just said, okay, now let's just do it.
Spring cleaning.
It is clear that there are some larger issues at play.
Interesting. Right. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, I would imagine that, you know, CNN has been pretty outspoken about moving to the right. And Don Lemon was a pretty outspoken voice, you know, left of center, critical of, let's say, Trump and Republicans. I don't want to, you know, say that he had any type of, like, real left ideology at all. But in terms of, like, you know, he was with the resistance, as it were. So that could have something to do with it. He's very much associated with that. Also the horrible things he said.
Yeah. Also, yeah.
But with that said,
him being generally kind of an asshole is what some people have said.
With that said, I want to thank my colleagues and many teams I have worked with for an incredible run. They are the most talented journalists in the business, and I wish them all the best. Let me just say that, like, was that guy, Tim, what's his name? Heidegger?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim Heidegger. You know, Tim Heidegger came at me at one point just praising
hard
Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo. That's his two favorite newscasters. And so let me just say this now to that Tim Heidegger guy.
Fella.
Guy.
Accountability time.
Where are your favorite hosts now, buddy? I'm still here behind the fancy backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
But your two favorite news guys who you said that I should emulate in some way, where are they?
Yeah.
Why don't you put that in your whatever pipe you lug around and smoke it?
CNN's PR account on Twitter has a response to Lemon's statement.
Oh, let's see it.
It's in lime green font.
CNN Communications. Well, wait a second. Do we know this is CNN Communications?
Yeah, it has a lot of followers.
Unfortunately.
The verification is not.
like, no longer because Twitter's so broken. A Twitter handle.
At CNN PR.
entitled CNN PR, which has 525,000. Well, how many likes does that have? How many viewers? I mean, no, wait. Go see.
The account has 158,000 followers.
Okay, so it could be. It could be.
Or it could be a really good parody that hasn't been found
yet. Lemon's statement about this morning's events is inaccurate.
He was offered an opportunity to meet with management, but instead released a statement on Twitter. Woo!
Okay, so, I mean, you know, it's not surprising. You fired, you know.
Why do I want to meet with you?
I'm not trying to challenge you on the left of center thing, but I am a little bit. Like, what is indicate? Everything I've seen is just like he doesn't like Trump, which makes him indistinguishable from any other.
I backed off at and said he's a member of the resistance,
okay,
as it were.
All right.
I
mean, and then CNN's like, yeah, that's, you know, last season.
Like,
yeah,
I felt like Chris Cuomo's commentary when he was on was more liberal or leftist than anything I've heard Don Lemon say.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I just didn't. I don't follow
leftist,
Don.
Please,
Don,
me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Jacobin, there's a new talent out there if you want to bring back the weekend show.
Well,
seems like a good fit.
I'm just glad that Tim Heidegger, however he's pronouncing his name these days.
Yeah.
Got put in his place. He probably won't even mention it.
No accountability these days.
Run scared. Sam's old lady glasses. Sam, you are in front of the backdrop. Fair enough.
Okay, that was Sam Cedar last Friday with Emmett Inland on the majority report talking about Tucker Carlson getting, I guess, amicably fired. And Don Lemon of CNN. Now we got John Grant on. He wanted to talk about this, so I thought we'd open up the show. What do you think about this shakeup last Friday on the two main networks?
Well, you know, I think I was delighted with it. You know, my wife told me about it. We like danced a jig in the kitchen. I mean, I think it's a big deal that Tucker Carlson goes down this way. You know, they cooked it up. Apparently, it's whether it was the old man Rupert Murdoch or his son Lackland, who's the CEO of Murdoch Publications, et cetera. Apparently, Tucker's been dissing Lackland and other management people and doing kinds of crazy independent things that they didn't like. And so they didn't tell him at all. One of the producers, a woman, named Scott, told him Monday morning that he was out. He wasn't even, you know, like even Bill O'Reilly, they gave him a parting show where he could wish his friends well and, you know, say goodbye. But they didn't even let him do that. They just ignominiously booted him out the door. They probably gave him, you know, a good severance package. That's probably the, you know, the way to do things like that. But, you know, it was pretty startling. Everybody at apparently what I just read, I think in this Talk of the Town in the New Yorker, everybody was, you know, shocked. Inside Fox News. So you know, it's just a continuation of the Dominion suit and the shakeout of that. And apparently, you know, he. Anyway, you know, he's done.
There's a report. Yeah, he's gone. Where will he go? Well, you know, I wonder if they were trying to avoid the second lawsuit coming up that they're probably going to want to settle after the first one with Dominion, the Dominion voting machines. Listeners that aren't up to speed, they paid $787 million. That's almost over three-quarters of $1 billion in a settlement with Dominion voting. And now another company, Smart Tech,
Smart-O-Matic or something like
that. And they avoided having all this testimony in depositions, you know, by paying the settlement. Now, maybe they're not going to be able to get out of the second round. And allegedly, I mean, it's not alleged. It's their actual emails talking to the various people in Fox News discussing among themselves and each other about the whole scam of declaring Trump the winner de facto.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean that's and
well, according to the three stories in the Times this morning, another thing was maybe a bigger thing than anything else was the upcoming lawsuit against Tucker Carlson's show for being misogynist and, you know, all kinds of, you know, abuses of people and things like that, that it was the same story as Bill O'Reilly. They just couldn't sustain it anymore. Their top flight guy becomes so arrogant and so, you know, ideologically and radically reinforced by his lunatic base and popularity that the management, in a sense, loses control. These guys feel more superior than the management, but of course, in the end, money rules. And it's interesting that the Succession, HBO's fictional version of the Murdoch empire, if you will, kind of loosely based on the Murdochs, is in its final season, and it's running a parallel kind of thing, and in the culture, and in fact, in the news on MSNBC and whatnot, I've heard three references to Succession. You know, so there's a fictional King Lear sort of drama of a Murdoch-like figure with Brian Cox, who has been chewing up the scenery for like four seasons, you know, in this Succession with his three children, two males and a female. And, so it's, as I say, it's in the arc of the culture now. People are thinking about this idea of, you know, this sort of publishing news, quote, empire on the right. And, this was a curveball to everybody. They didn't expect this. And it was, there was no second thoughts. They just did it and booted him out the door Monday morning. You know, they sucked it up and did it. And so you wonder, somebody like Tucker Carlson is, as is argued in some of these stories, he's a vindictive kind of person. He really holds grudges, and he goes off on these florid sort of rants about the outrageous white supremacist ideas and all this stuff that he's been quite effectively mainstreaming for a while. So what is he going to do next? The first job offer he got was like, I think something like 10 minutes after he announced it, and RT, Russian television, right? He's pro-Putin. He defends Putin and all this stuff. They love him over there in Russia in the propaganda lines. And they offered, sure, come on over here. We'll treat you really well. I can't imagine he would go to work for RT. I think he's probably going to... God, he could go directly into politics. I mean, he could become an advisor to Trump and things like that. I mean, all kinds of things that this lunatic might do. So it's going to be interesting. As always, it's entertainment. It's part of the entertainment network of America. Donald Trump took entertainment to, we no longer, need to read novels. We can just follow the career of this man Donald Trump, and it's like a huge Norman Mailer novel about the ins and outs of power and corruption, and it's unfolding before our eyes, but anyway.
Well, the emails that were leaked, I don't even think they were leaked. I think they just came out. I don't, I'll have to track a little bit. They just came out in the course of the hearings against Fox.
Dominion
had Dominion had Tucker Carlson saying Donald Trump was a demonic spirit or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he called it demonic.
He hated
you know,
him. I hate him passionately, he told somebody.
Yeah.
But apparently after that, he had a nice, smooth meeting with Donald Trump. And they immediately smoothed it over. Because, as somebody wrote, I forgot where I wrote it, but there's so much written about Trump, it's hard to remember where you read it. But somebody was writing about the phenomenon that Donald Trump had perfected of being hated and letting that as a, almost like a leapfrog you into even more excitement and, you know, ironically beloved attraction. You know, it's all part of the I could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, you know. You know, it's like I don't care, mention my, you know, it's the old idea of whatever you say, I don't care, mention my name and spell the name right, you know. So somebody like Tucker Carlson, who's, you know, probably a, you know, a bit of a sociopathic bullshit liar, just like Donald Trump, you know, these two get together and, oh, they can smooth that over perfectly because, you know, they're both focused on power and have abandoned truth a long time ago. And so, you know, Donald will forgive Tucker as long as he's polishing his shoes and, you know, performing whatever he's performing on him, you know, because his interview the other day, I watched a lot of it, and as not only me noted, other people noted it, Tucker Carlson virtually said nothing. He would say, what do you think of X? And, you know, the guy would, he would just sit there in his chair. As my wife said, it looked like he was taking a dump. And, you know, the way he was standing looking at Trump, and he would just adoringly, you know, stare at him, and Trump just get went on and on and on, you know. And it was probably one of the more amazing interviews I've ever seen because there was zero effort to, you know, like peel the layers back and try to find out what this man was saying. It was simply like, go, turn on your, you can talk, and if it flags, I'll ask another stupid question, and you can talk for another 20 minutes. And, you know, and Donald Trump just goes off and, you know, pirouettes and spirals all these garbage nonsense narratives. And it's pretty amazing, actually, to watch. I mean, sad, really, really pathetic and sad that this is, you know, what these people are dishing out as journalism and, you know, whatever.
Well, you know, I think I'm wondering, you know, NPR in the aftermath of the settlement. NPR interview, and I should have wrote the guy's name. He's a qualified source that they talked to about the $787 million settlement.
Sure.
And they said, well, it is an astronomical figure, but the sums of money I think we're talking about is so beyond the comprehension of many Americans, let alone, you know, let alone people in the quote unquote undeveloped countries.
Right.
So, I mean, this source said, I distinctly remember them saying this, that that it's like all they have to do is go to the cable companies,
right,
and insist on raising their service package to the cable companies at $3 per customer, cable customer.
Right.
So now that,
and they'll
that's
pay off, pay it off.
It'll pay off that. It'll pay off that over three quarter billion dollars.
Well,
one,
I think what Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, I think that's in just a year. And, I mean, it's right. So astronomical, the fees. I mean, Carlson reportedly, according to Forbes magazine, was getting $20 million a year at Fox. And that is really much. $20 million a year at Fox. And Don Lemon from CNN, he was getting approximately $4 million and uh-huh. a net worth of 12. That's according to The Street, .com. I'm sort of shocked that most Americans who are overwhelmingly struggling, working two and three jobs between the two of them to support one home, having a family, an active family life, I think they could set. You get home, you put your feet up on your recliner, you sit back, and you turn on this stuff, and you're being propagandized, and you're doing.
Oh, no question.
It's like the madness of a billionaire, a mad billionaire society. It's a society that people just don't set back. You know, it's also after Rachel Maddow gets $30,000 a show. Now she has quit. Uh-huh. She announced she was retiring just 2 months in the winter. She announced she's going to quit February, but I still see her on. So I'm like going,
did a deal where she does a show on Mondays.
Uh-huh.
And another woman, I can't think of her name right now, does the show Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And then they have weekend talking heads. So Rachel Maddow does a show on Mondays. She's kind of the headliner of MSNBC.
That's why I picked on her.
And yesterday, her Monday show, and Rachel Maddow is at her best when she just does these open-ended ad-lib essays. You know, she's not reading anything. She does a lot of research, obviously. She's very smart.
Yeah.
And, she can be a pain in the ass. I know. I've talked to a lot of my male buddies, and, they get sick of her, a little skinny and lesbian in black, But I think her essay yesterday was the best thing, the focused on the Tucker Carlson phenomenon. Because I think what all of this, the Dominion, that huge 857 million, or whatever it was, 787, I don't know.
787.
Huge amount of money. And as you say, 20 million for Tucker Carlson, for God's sakes. What this is, as you suggested, this is just a tale of early 21st century Gilded Age robber baron, billionaire heavy sort of plutocratic corruption in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, as I've said for 10 years, our problems aren't ideological now. It's all about corruption. The money has, airlifted all the way up to the top. I mean, it's going against gravity, And there's just so much money up at the top. And, the Republicans have, gone radical white supremacist and all that. And it's crazy. It's just simply a crazy town. And, people don't like to look at it that way, that, they're living in a culture that's gone to crazy town. But, look at all the dynamics. Look at all the money that we're talking about. And, as Ozzie Meyer famously put it, our South Philly congressman caught in the ab scam thing in, the late 70s, I guess it was. His famous line was, we'll live in history. In this town, money talks and bullshit walks. That has become the mantra for American corruption, it seems to me. And this is why Donald Trump, you know, rises out of the muck of the swamp that he referred to. You know, he was going to clean out the swamp.
You know? He's part of it.
He's like, he's he like the chief reptile, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, we all know this by now. Everybody in America knows this.
No, we don't.
Part down
no,
to their
don't.
Soles of their feet, and you know.
No,
well,
I don't
they
think we
do. I mean, they don't know enough to know the details. They just know they're, pardon the expression, they're fucked, I think. You know, and we have all sorts of bread and circus, you know, as you say, Netflix, On Demand, HBO, you know, we have so many options for bread and circus and distraction, and that, you know, I think we're a lost, talk about a lost generation back in Hemingway's yeah. days. You know, we are just, you know, swimming. We're just lost. We're in a, that's a real cheerful
well,
idea, I know.
Well, then I get these text messages on these goddamn
right.
phones that we carry around.
Right.
And this morning before the show, there's guys that not one but like six of these text messages. It's a rainbow flag. A rainbow flag, you know, the image is a rainbow flag with a cross and sickle. And it says, and it's announcing that transgender protectors are starting a crowdsourced fund, GoFundMe or something like that.
Okay, GoFundMe, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, these crowdsourced money
sure,
things.
Sure,
you know,
yeah, various venues for that.
I can't remember the name of it. I can't remember the name of the thing. It's a very popular one. To raise money so that the trans can buy guns. I just think this is one. I think it's outrageous that they put the hammer and sickle on it. Okay, two, because I have a stupidly romantic thing about the hammer and sickle. But I will say this: getting yourself guns in a public forum on a GoFundMe page is about the stupidest thing you could do.
Who do you think's behind that?
I'm getting ready to follow up. I don't know, but there's like six of these pleas for money, and I'm like going, I'm wondering, is this some sort of provocateur starting this outrageous?
Well, that's
thing,
my first
I mean?
Question is whose advantage is this meme, if you will, in this world we live in of stupidity and garbage and corruption and phoniness and fakeness. I mean, to whose advantage is this meme that transgender people are buying guns to get revenge? And, of course, there was that, you know, shooting in where was it, Kentucky or was it Tennessee? You know, with a trans woman, I guess, you know, or according to Bill Maher, a quote, woman who still had a penis, you know. So, which is one of my questions about transgender people. You're not supposed to talk to them about these details. You know, they want to tell you how to, you know, how you're supposed to treat them, but they can't and won't because it's a secret. It's a little protected secret. What their particular intimate gender issues are. And, of course, it should be. It's none of my business. But, you know, if you're insisting on, you know, a certain identity with people around the world who are, you know, a little confused by this transgender thing, you know, it makes it difficult. But so whose benefit is this memic idea, if that's an adjective, memic idea, that that you know, transgender people are arming them. Well, that's, you know, that's carte de blanche to go out and shoot them. And, you know, hey, look at, they're arming to come get us. Well, we get them first, you know. So you got to get over that question. Like, who the fuck is funding that thing? You know?
You're talking about the alt-right, straight, so-called straight communities. Is that what you're saying? Yeah, they're getting armed, so let's go shoot the trans. Because
you have to, in order, I mean, it's the first rule of making war, you know, it's the next step after the first casualty is truth. The next step is, well, you got to demonize the sons of bitches so that you can slit their throats and bleed them out, you know? I mean, you got to demonize them.
I don't know how I got
it. It's hard to kill them, you know.
I didn't mean to throw that into the conversation about Don Lemon and Tucker Carlson, but I think it reflects the kind of chaos that's going on underneath
these figureheads,
right. And it's pretty unnerving for me, because it's like, this is like, to me,
right.
It's like, my God, it's like the society, even the fringe, the fringe. I mean, who would think trans people, what few I know, or are some of the most gentlest people I know,
exactly,
start getting guns and this is like
it doesn't make sense.
It's like,
you know, it doesn't make
no,
sense.
No, it's like some and I'll track down the source.
Well, I can understand in the logic and the traditions and the model example of, ACT UP. Remember when ACT UP, homosexuals were all fed up being harassed? And, some of them went out and worked out in the gym and stood there and say, okay, fuck with me, you sons of bitches, you straight bastards. You know, because, homosexuals don't have to be weak and humble. They can be strong, arrogant, and cruel and sadistic like anybody else, you know. And, I just am a little leery of this idea that transgender people are out there arming themselves when, like you say, they're generally gentle people who just want to be left alone.
Right.
And so they're not going to be go out and getting guns and publicizing that. I mean, if they do get guns, they'll keep it secret. And like the woman in Tennessee or the person in Tennessee. So I would imagine that there's some questions about that GoFundMe page, especially after they have the example, the fodder, the model, the provocative, the trigger of this transgender person in Tennessee shooting up a school, killing six people. I mean, to me, I would suggest that might be the roots of this false flag, if you will, of GoFundMe, false flag. But
Here's
I suspect.
Who's the interest? I mean, Tucker Carlson seems to come to mind the most, more so than Don Lemon, in terms of, not just because who makes the most money among the two of them, but I think whose interest are being served by promoting this kind of extreme bloody violence as the first resort among dissident groups in a society. I mean, is it the class interest? Is it anything revolutionary in this kind of mentality, or is it really just madness in terms of violent, anarchistic violence?
Right.
Seems to serve. I mean, there's a guy who I've had on the show a couple times. His name's Stan Cox. It's Salina, Kansas. He's an established. He's a great writer on environmentalism. And he's got several books published. And his latest article is on Tom Dispatch right now today, listeners. And the headline is not a green bone in their white bodies. That's the headline. Subtitle: How Eco-Fascists Are Fueling Racism and Deadly Violence. And he points out some of the roots of the what they call, they're calling themselves eco-fascists. Mm-hmm. And these are people on the far right, or I mean, maybe you could say the far left too, who are advocating, you know, accelerationist collapse mm-hmm. of the society by
right.
blowing up power transformers, shooting transformers, electric,
creating
down
chaos.
The electric grid,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Creating anarchy and
right.
chaos is anarchy. And he reviews the history of this and how it's all morphing into this thing about millions of illegal aliens are going to harm the environment. So what we got to stop the millions of illegal aliens from harming the environment. Now he's not saying that. He's saying it's like they're melting together
mm-hmm.
these trends of violence and and racism. You know, that's why the headline is, it's at Tom's Dispatch, listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Cox, COX, as the fuck it sounds, spreading hate mm-hmm. and bullets is the headline. This will probably appear on Counterpunch also. Not a green mm-hmm. bone in their white bodies. But I mean, this is I think Tucker Carlson bears a huge amount of responsibility for that. And Glenn Greenwald and others, Jimmy Dore. I mean, I think Matt Taibbi to a certain extent, and even, I just appear on his show.
Well, Matt Taibbi is one of the kind of crossovers from left to the right. You know, he kind of
Wouldn't you call Glenn Greenwald? Wouldn't you call Glenn Greenwald?
Well, of course, Glenn Greenwald. Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard was on Sean Hannity last night. Big as day, just as she's a contributor at Fox News now. And I would not be shocked to see Tulsi
uh-huh.
Gabbard take over the 8 o'clock spot on Fox, you know, that Tucker spot. You know, they're gonna do what I think MSNBC did it. They'll do it. You know, when somebody's out, they just open that slot, and such and such a person does a week, such and such a person does another week. And I would imagine Tulsi Gabbard, who has subbed for Tucker Carlson a couple times, I would not be surprised if they test her out and that she becomes, because I think one of the things that Tucker Carlson was doing, and, you know, I've talked about this for probably a year, is recruiting for strange bedfellow connections between the populist far right and the populist far left. You know, this is one of my pet issues. And Tulsi Gabbard and Glenn Greenwald were, factors in that. And as I say, Tulsi Gabbard has subbed for Tucker Carlson at least twice. And, so that's a really interesting phenomenon. This idea that I nurse that there is a strange bedfellows compulsion between the far left and the far right, because they both viscerally hate the deep state and the Hillary Clintons and all the Bidens and all those liberal whack jobs, are the Democrats. Anyway, you've heard me.
I'm just trying to point out some of the commonality. Tulsi Gabbard, Jimmy Dore, Glenn Greenwald. Mm-hmm. Now, Glenn Greenwald, not so much. He's not so much anti-war, but he is, supposedly. All these guys, and Tucker Carlson. You know, this began with the Biden arming the Ukrainians, okay?
You're right.
And,
no question.
And, I mean, and so it's this, to be anti-war, you have to, you have to appear on Fox News. That's how it works, and because that's the most watched, quote unquote, news network. That therefore that gives you street cred with the old white folks in the recliners watching the thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Are we going to see a lot of old white people suddenly proclaiming themselves anti-war?
Well, again, that's kind of what I'm talking about, because one of the issues I'm convinced in the 2024 election is from the Republicans is going to be a lower the defense budget line. And the way they're going to do that is to give Ukraine to the Russians in a way, stop the war by pulling back American funding of the war. I mean, I guess that's what in the vital end of the Vietnam War was that when Congress, you know, pulled the rug out from under it by not voting the money to support it. So this is an issue that is going to be a crossover in some way, shape, or form. I'm not sure how it'll pan out. Between the populist right and the populist left. It's all about, in my view, the future of this, what I call the new great imperialist game. It's, there was European colonialism and then there was American imperialism. Well, there's a whole new gig starting with the internet age and whatnot, technology and the rise of the rest, as they call it, and the idea that China is going to eat our lunch economically. All these issues, these big meta stories that are going on in the world now, it's a brave new world, and you got people with imperialist designs like Vladimir Putin. He wants Ukraine. He wants to run the goddamn place because he feels he deserves it. It's part of our imperial given. This is a given in Russia that it owns Ukraine. And of course, China wants Taiwan. That's all part of it and all that kind of stuff. And of course, we want Central America. We've always wanted Central America. We'll still probably want that. Although, interesting enough, in this, Honduras, the country that has been fucked by the United States probably more than any other Central American little country, and, of course, Obama and Hillary Clinton, completely blew off the coup in 2009 in which they threw out Manuel Zelaya, they didn't do a goddamn thing about it, Obama and Hillary. They sat on their asses. And meanwhile, Zelaya's wife is now the president of Honduras, and Honduras has publicly sided with China on Taiwan. It says, fuck Taiwan. I mean, Honduras is now in the position in Central America saying, we're for China. Let them have Taiwan. Little Honduras, the country was named by is such a, quote, shithole that it was named by conquistadors. The word Honduras means ditch. They named the country the ditch. So Honduras is a basket. Well, it's decided enough of this Monroe Doctrine crap. We're fishing for Chinese money to develop our country. The United States abandons us, and so things are happening here, in this idea called the new great game, new imperialist game, and Donald Trump would be the man to pull that off vis-a-vis the rest of the world with the United States. He's already made it clear he wants to be an authoritarian. And so he will work vis-a-vis the Chinese and the Russians is to say, like they did after World War II and Potsdam and whatnot, they carved up the world, that these people want to carve up the world. And, that's what's at play here, it seems to me. Whether the United States will go along with this idea of a new imperialist great game or whether it's trying to hold on to its past dominance as the, the big swinging dick of the world, And so, we're in the middle of all this craziness, And, of course, you wanted – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, then today, Biden formally announces he's going to run for re-election. He'll be 84 if he makes it that far through his second term. Right. He'll be 84. Dianne Feinstein, 89. She seems to be so out of it from the alleged quote-unquote shingles. There are rumors, credible rumors, that she has Alzheimer's and dementia, and there's been nothing coming from her. It's all her staff speaking for San Francisco. And How many years did she have left
on her term? Do we know that?
No, I think two more years, I think.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
Whether she'll hold out for 2 years.
It might be 4 years. It might be 4 years on a six-year term. And then we have more in the mix, more. From the Sacramento Bee, that's in California, listeners, sacbee.com, sacbee.com. An article which is paywalled, but they throw up as a teaser, and I've heard this from other news sources, that Robert F. Kennedy, RFK Jr.
Right.
And I watched his speech, you know, and I shared this on my phone with people, which I try to use as a real instrument to inform people. And I shared his announcement speech last week, I think it was, or sometime lately. And he gave a 2-hour speech in Boston, and some of the Democrats I sent it to, I'm not going to say their names, said, you know, I'll vote for him because he comes out and the insanity of the anti-war, of the war, funding the war in Ukraine, and a lot of other things too. Of course, how he's one of the people, and it comes out now to the Sacramento Bee newspaper that Steve Bannon recommended Bobby Kennedy Jr. To run for president.
Well, that's clear what's going on there. I mean, it's very clear what's going on.
Because that would Bannon says it would be, quote, a chaos bomb, unquote.
Right, exactly. That's anarchy, chaos, as you were talking about. You know, Steve Bannon is the master of that. You know, he's the and of course, he knows that Robert Kennedy Jr. is a lunatic. He's kind of lost his bearings somewhere along the line, and he's become a bit of a, you know, potential demagogue. He went off on the vaccine stuff and did some pretty stupid stuff, and you know, he's doing the kind of crazy, lying, bullshitting stuff that the right loves to do, but he's sort of doing it as a Democrat. And he's going to run in the primaries against Biden, I guess, you know. And I don't know. I think maybe, like Lyndon Johnson in, 1970 or 60, 72, I guess it was, said he's not, that he was primaried when I guess, you know, what, Eugene McCarthy beat him in New Hampshire, I think it was.
That was in 68, brother.
68. Yeah, 68. That was way back in 68. Okay. Well, 72,
Nixon,
he didn't run.
Nixon came in after that.
What? I know. Well, he didn't run. He was going to run for re-election, then he chose not to.
No, he didn't run.
He'd seen the light, right?
He says he came to you as a barefoot boy from Texas, if I remember correctly. As a barefoot boy from Texas. I will not seek nor accept the nomination.
Right.
President of the United States. I think it's something like that.
Well, forget all that history. If 70% poll. Well, you're missing my point. If we worry about all that stuff, the point is 70% currently now of Americans polled think that Biden shouldn't run. And I think it's like 69% or 9% of Democrats said he shouldn't run. So it's pretty clear that a majority of Americans, especially Democrats, wish the old fucker wouldn't run. And I'm with them. I wish Biden had the grace, you know, like a lot of leaders do, when it's their time's up, you know, they foster someone else. And I think there are many, many, many younger, more capable people to maneuver this country through this particularly crazy, rocky shoals that it's in the world right now.
I just don't think
Joe Biden, who, you know, looks like, I mean, I'm 70, 75, almost 76, and, you know, my legs aren't what they used to be, you know, so I'm doing a walking regime to try to get better strength and whatnot, but I'm very tentative on my legs. Well, you know, he's 80, I guess. So I can, whenever I see the poor man walking around, so I go, oh, my God, I feel for you, you know. I really feel for the guy, you know. At the same time, that doesn't mean I want to vote for you again, you know. I mean, I've written articles to think what a shitbag you are, and I'm going to vote for you again? Why? You know, it's like there's
more
better
prison,
people.
I mean, he's got such a shit track record.
Yeah.
But then you got Donald Trump, who's, you know,
well, of course.
Donald
Trump's
not,
virtually
not,
is virtually as old. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
He's
yeah,
what? 76. He's like 6 months younger than me. Is he 70?
I think he's
76.
I think.
Yeah,
I'll
he's like 6 months older than me. I think something like
that. But he's such a crook himself. I mean, the American people are really. I mean, I will use the pronoun we now.
Right.
We as the citizens of this country are fucked. We really are. I mean,
and why?
I mean, really,
but why is that? Because we have let the fucking capitalists so condition this country that it becomes impossible to change it. In other words, the money is so top heavy in this country these days.
Uh-huh.
You know, as we say, the age of the robber barons and the Gilded Age, 1890s and whatnot. It's no wonder democracy's on the ropes. I mean, it's not Donald Trump's fault.
Yeah.
He's just an example of the opportunities for demagoguery that the corruption in America, you know, makes front and center. You know, he's simply, you know, he's not cause, he's effect, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we think, we blame Donald Trump for everything, but he's not to blame for anything. He's just, you know, it's like, you know, psychopathy isn't a mental illness. It's a condition of having the moral conscience of a tiger, you know what I mean?
He was a crook long before he ran.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, what was sad is that the American public just—they don't do. I don't think they knew the reason. I think people in New York City, I would say upstate New York City, knew
right.
He was a crook. You know, absolutely.
Well, New York City is the pinnacle of corruption, for God's sakes. You know, I mean.
Well, I would say that they'd watched his shenanigans for better than 40 years.
Oh, absolutely.
From across, as he came in
from
Jersey.
Brooklyn to Manhattan. Yeah.
Yeah. And the guy, I mean, they watched it, big headlines in their town, in their local tabloid newspapers. I mean,
right.
He was screwing, the shenanigans he would pull to promote himself. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Right.
But the rest of the country didn't. They didn't get those
right.
tabloid headlines. They didn't have the living experience of watching this con artist work the grift so hard on.
Well, but to me, my view is Manhattan made the man. In other words, the corruption of, we bought Manhattan from the Indians for a bunch of bracelets and necklaces
right.
or something. You know,
right.
from
right.
that moment on, you know. Look at some fiction, but look at you know, Scorsese's, what's the one about the...
Gangs of New York?
Gangs of New York. I mean, look at how corruption, you know, the boss Tweed and all that
violence.
Stuff. And,
right.
You know, violence in the streets between the you know, the national, you know, the nativists and, you know, what, Bill the Butcher and, you know, just frightening violence during that period. And so all of that corruption is, you know, the loam and the nurturing ground and the earth of Manhattan. And, you know, it spawned someone like Donald Trump. But it also, you also have, because New York is, I think, at the sort of pinnacle of, you know, corruption in America, you know, J.P. Morgan and all the robber barons were in New York, that it also has a strain of counter-demagoguery and liberalism that has been learned and earned because of the great corruption of New York, so that you do have New York as a complex thing with a very strong liberal strain in it. You know, that's not letting the robber barons take over 100%. You know, so, you know, you get the strains in New York where, you know, this district attorney could be, you know, the downfall of Donald Trump. The Manhattan DA, you know, Manhattan creates him, but Manhattan takes him down, too. And, there are all kinds of interesting narratives going on here.
Yeah, when you screwed people in the Midwest and the belt buckle, mm-hmm. Georgia, I mean, they announced today that they're setting up for, they're adding for added security measures as they announced these criminal charges against Donald Trump and gang.
Well, this is the state of Margaret Taylor Greene, you know. I mean, you know, she came all the way to New York to piss and moan and this and that. You know, can you imagine what she's going to do in Georgia to Fannie Willis? You know, it's like, of course, Fannie Willis wants all the sheriff's department to be on notice, you know.
Right.
National Guard, get ready, you know. It's like,
Well, you touched on how bad can be in the movie Gangs of New York for the listeners to check it out. If you missed it, I wouldn't recommend watching it with your kids and popcorn.
Oh, it's an excellent film. It's excellent as a fictional history to think about that era, you know.
It's not really as fictional as you think. There's a book about it. I have the book.
Well, of course.
I read the book. And Scorsese, the man who made the movie, read the book and used it. And it's a distillation. It compacts a lot of things happening, but they're all based. The names of the gangs are real. The locations of the riots are real. The streets where the anti-draft, Civil War draft, Civil War draft occurred, which turned into a race riot where they lynched black people there.
Yep.
It's a distillation and compaction of history. I've read the book, and it's definitely accurate. So the movie, like I said, I wouldn't recommend watching it with your kids, minors, or young kids. But I would certainly hardly. And there's two others. These are on Netflix, by the way. One I watched this week. I'll be very quick, so you can get in your chat.
Yeah, go ahead.
Don't Pick Up the Phone, a very low-budget true crime series, three 44-minute segments, so you don't have to have a long binge. And Don't Pick Up the Phone is a very interesting study in Americana. Here is a man named David, spoiler alert, a prison correction guard who is a hot dog wannabe cop, places hundreds of phone calls to Burger King and McDonald's all around the country in a very authoritative voice, convincing the store managers of all these little fast food chains to get a woman into the thing and say that there's a reported theft and you're going to have to strip search her, the manager. And they did it. They did. They strip searched these minors all over the country based on these hoax phone calls placed all over the country. It's And it's much more deeper than that. But it's a real, it's a real time example of why Fox News works in terms of.
Now, this is on Netflix or what?
On Netflix. On Netflix. It's called.
And what's it called again?
It's called Don't Pick Up the Phone.
Don't pick up the phone. Okay, I'll check
Very
it out.
Very simple. Yeah. Because it's, all these store managers are answering the phone. This guy out of Panama, oh, by the way, for your information, John, out of Panama City, Florida, of course, everything comes to Florida in terms of psychotic criminals. He's a prison guard, wannabe hot cop. He gets on the phone and by his calling cards, we think they're making him anonymous, called over 200 documented places over 10 years, and has all these store managers, these fast food store managers, strip searching young, nubile, minor women. I guess some boys too, strip searching, including the cavity, including doing cavity searches. You'll know what that means. It's an incredible
I think
movie.
I'm a big boy. I can figure that one out.
Yeah, and this happened in 2002, I believe, 2002,
wow.
2004, and it tells, and he got away with it. They tracking some intrepid, hardworking country detectives tracking down, and that's a spoiler. I mean, he gets away with it. He basically gets away
with
it.
Well, I'll have to check it out.
I wanted to ask you.
Now,
wait, I got one more real quick. Okay, another one. Now, this one came out in 2022 on Netflix, and it's a comedy drama. And I think once you talk about it, it's called White Noise, and it's directed by Noam Bamba. White Noise.
Well, it's a film, right? Yeah, it's a film. It's a Don DeLillo novel.
Yeah. And the movie on Netflix is absolutely, it is so hard-hitting comedy. It's so hard hitting in comedy. I think you're the one that told me it's absurdist comedy. I know it's called that on other books. But I mean, it's an incredible scathing critique of higher education and of consumerism.
Right. It's, the protagonist is he's got a tenured position in Hitler studies. Yeah, Hitler studies.
Very good, John.
And,
yeah, very good. Yeah, you're right. Go on.
I read the book. I read Don DeLillo's book, and you know, it's a classic. And it was from the 80s, like early 80s.
Yeah.
And
it's
a toxic event. There's a toxic event that sort of. Kind of hovers through
like
the novel.
It was a lot. When I watched the movie, I thought, "My God, this movie is like." They made this before all the railroad accidents with chemicals,
right?
You know, like East Palestine. You know, they had the wreckage recently in it.
Sure,
you know,
exactly. Right on time, absolutely. Yeah.
And, I mean, I was watching. I thought, "My God, what is this?" So I thought, "I've got to write about this."
Well, I would suggest if you feel like reading a good novel, White Noise is a Don DeLillo, DeLLO, is one of the great modern novels. White Noise, it's again a dark comedy. You know, very good. Now,
those two movies I highly recommend to you and all the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Because that encapsulates, in my opinion, what's wrong with America today.
Now, tell me, what is it, Call Me, Don't Call Me, or what was that first name?
Don't Pick Up the Phone.
Don't Pick
really,
Up, okay, I'll write that.
That's the name of it, Don't Pick Up the Phone, okay? Mm-hmm. Just Google it.
Now, did you want to talk, we were going to talk about Talk of the Town and the abortion stuff.
Oh well, we're only down to a minute now, so we'll have to hold that. And that's abortion.
But you know, that's an eternal, that's a perennial issue, and of course, this crazy battle of the federal judges—the one from Texas and the one from Washington State—you know, and the Supreme Court—it's a really great story. So we should maybe pick that up next week.
Next week. Well, we'll go
because
like,
May
14th is when we'll know if they're going to Comstock law. That's what I yelled at you over
the
phone.
Right, Comstock law, exactly.
They're going to use this Comstock law. I got a local history on the Comstock law, how it's used. So we got a lot to talk about when it comes to
Right.
But the
use of this West Texas, I guess, district where people, you know, can selectively choose what court you want to have your suit in. But anyway,
yeah,
we'll pick it up.
It's going to be a mess. John Grant, thank you, John. Great.
Okay, Mike Cannell.